Adele, what inspired you to go into a life in the arts or want to be an artist?
I just always knew that I wanted to be an artist. I grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska. My mother wasn't a painter, and she used to paint in our family room. And so from an early age, I watched her struggle with it, and she would make a painting, and then she'd paint it out, and then she'd go back in and make a bunch of changes, and then she'd paint it out, and just, it was this continual kind of, it was all about the process and about, you know, when she was happy with it, she'd stop. So that was a huge influence. And then my grandmother was also an artist. She went to school at Columbia in New York City and then taught art at the University of Nebraska. And my great-grandmother was an artist. So I was exposed to it, even though I lived in Lincoln, Nebraska. Most of the art that I fell in love with were in coffee table books. Although we did have a good gallery in Lincoln called the Sheldon Memorial Art Gallery, which still has very good curatorial work. You know, we would go there often to see the art shows. So I think I just fell in love with the activity, with the struggle of it, mm-hmm. and watching something emerge.
Mm-hmm. Where did you go to school?
I went to undergraduate, University of Nebraska, Lincoln. Worked with Mike Neuschog primarily and James Eisentrager. So they were a big, I originally wanted to be a painter, and I took a printmaking course just for the fun of it, for another elective, and I fell in love with printmaking. I think a lot of it was how challenging it is. I like a good challenge. So that really hooked me, and I also like the social aspects of it. You're not in your studio alone working. You're with other people. And that's very important.
Can you talk a little bit about the dynamic of creating prints and that sort of thing? You mentioned you work in a group setting. Can you talk about that a little more?
Well, yeah, with printmaking, it's a slow process, usually. So you're making things in increments, you know, from somewhere from where the idea begins or where the first marks begin until throughout the whole process. It's an extended period of time. So there's lots of time within that to change your mind or to make, you know, maybe embrace a mistake and keep a record of it, especially when you're working with color and you have a lot of different states of a print that it goes through. There's lots of unexpected things that happen. So it's kind of this, starting out with something very concrete in your head, but then often ending up someplace very different, and having the time to think and reflect, and the social aspect. I'm generally a very reclusive person, so it's nice because it brings me out of my shell.
Mm-hmm. Because you're sharing your studio. Or the studio equipment.
Right, you have to cooperate with people, and just the joking around, just having fun, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just, printmakers are really fun. Mm-hmm. I really like sculptors for that, too. So most of my artist friends have usually been either printmakers or sculptors. They're very social people.
You mentioned you went to the University of Nebraska. Mm-hmm. Is that the only school you attended?
Or? I also, I did my graduate work at Arizona State University. It was a good experience for me. Mm-hmm. Gave me a lot of confidence and got me out of my shell. So.
Who are some of your most important influences as you were sort of figuring out the route you wanted to go with your art?
Well, Mike Neuschog in Nebraska, I always admired him a lot because he really thought about what he was going to say. He didn't have like a little routine or pat answers. He was a very insightful person. So I always hoped to be like him. And then when I went to Arizona State, I worked with Rip Woods, and it was sort of a similar thing. I'd ask him something, and 3 days later, he'd answer me. And I drive my students a little bit nuts sometimes because I take my time to think about things and answer like Rip did. And I'm hoping that will be, you know, that I'm just not talking, that it's something that is you know, I'd rather say less and have it be more constructive, mm-hmm. if I can. So that's kind of my goal.
So you're a professor now. Where do you teach?
I teach at the University at Buffalo, State University of New York. I teach printmaking, and I'm the director of graduate studies, which is a wonderful job.
Could you talk about your art and what you create and why you create what you create?
That's always a difficult question. If you could look at the work, if I could show you the work and talk about each particular series, it would do a lot towards explaining where I'm going with it and why I'm making it. A lot of my work, generally speaking, it's influenced perhaps by my experience when I was very young, growing up in Lincoln with the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis in particular. There was an Air Force base in Omaha about 50 miles away, the Strategic Air Command, and when the Bay of Pigs and all of the nuclear threats, people coming, Bob Hope coming on TV and telling us how to prepare and duck and cover and all of that. And of course, I'm not alone there. The whole baby boom generation kind of went through this. But my father built a fallout shelter in the basement, and it had like a big lead door to put over it. It had like 250 gallon drums of water. It had an air machine, enough food for a couple months. Also, growing up in Nebraska with the threat of tornadoes, as a very young age, I became kind of acutely aware of anything could happen anytime and that I could be dead and that I could lose my family and so forth. So I think at a young age, I've been kind of preoccupied with death, not in a negative way, but just sort of trying to figure out like how to live my life and how to maybe try to be more aware of each moment and be present in the moment. So that's kind of what my work is about. It's very political in a lot of ways, although it's not real overtly political. I try to make it beautiful and make it look seductive so that people want to look at it. Hopefully, I can draw people in. I read the paper every day. It's very important. I read the New York Times and the Buffalo News at a minimum, and then I read some magazines too and listen to the radio. So a lot of my work is very influenced by current events, even though a lot of it has a kind of pseudo-antique or maybe 17th century kind mm-hmm. of quality to mm-hmm. it.
Growing up in the Cold War and being very influenced by that, compared to where we are now, especially in the U.S., mm-hmm. in this era of homeland security and a kind of high state of tension, mm-hmm. again, does that influence your work, and do you see it continually growing with the changing threats?
Yeah, I mean, I'm quite discouraged in some ways, about a lot of things going on in the world, what might happen with Israel and Iran and those kinds of things. I'm also very concerned with environmental things that are going on. I did a number of series that were kind of based on this idea of Cheney's 1% doctrine. A lot of people have already forgotten about it, which kind of amazes me because it really stuck in my head. Aaron Susskind was sort of paraphrasing what Cheney had said, and it was, even if there's just a 1% chance of the unimaginable coming true, act as if it's a certainty. It's not about our analysis, as Cheney said. It's about our response. Justified or not, fact-based or not, it's our response that matters. And he was talking, that was before we went into Iran. Mm-hmm. So the evidence bar was set so low Iraq, mm-hmm. I said Iran, that the word almost didn't apply. I've traveled through the Middle East. When I finished my undergraduate work in Lincoln, I wanted to see the world, and I went on an adventure alone. And I went to England, and then I went overland to India. And I was really most interested in India, although I had hoped to go to Indonesia. I didn't make it that far, but I was sort of seeking some sort of enlightenment, I met a lot of gurus and did a lot of that kind of thing. There were a lot of people like me who I met on the road. But on the trip, I went through Turkey and Iran. I didn't go to Iraq, and Afghanistan. And I spent about a month in each in Iran and Afghanistan. And that experience, it was right before the Shah was brought down, so it was a long time ago. And I was just like a 21-year-old girl with blonde hair, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I'm lucky to be alive. But the thing about when we went into Iran that just made me, it still makes me insanely angry, is if you knew anything about that country or Afghanistan, you would never fight those people. You know, they're not giving up. They're never giving up, ever, 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 ever. That's just, you know, it's who they are. And we're looking at centuries of this. And to have the kind of, I don't know, it's like if Bush had traveled, you know, if everyone traveled, it would be a completely different world. You know, I tell my students that, you know, talking about giving advice to students, I tell them to travel, you know, get out of Buffalo, you know, especially these kids that spend their whole life here. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Do you hope to achieve with your art?
Nothing. no, I mean, I hope a lot of what I hope to achieve, it's a very selfish kind of, I'm not going to pretend that it's not. What's really wonderful is when people look at it and get it and get a lot out of it and kind of understand what I'm talking about. A lot of what my work is kind of tongue-in-cheek, and it's kind of funny and sad at the same time, and I'm kind of, you know, it's kind of like that old Mexican, you know, like laughing in the face of death. You know, I mean, what are you going to do? You know, it's nice to have shows, it's nice to be acknowledged and all that, but it's really not why I make the work. I make the work because I enjoy being creative. And it's really difficult. I mean, there's so many times when you just feel like you're a failure or that your work isn't any good and that kind of thing. And that's normal, you know. And so that's another thing I try to teach my students is to, you know, not to be too critical, just to keep making things. And realize that nobody cares. If you don't care, nobody cares. So, I mean, that, it all begins with the artist. You have to care about what you're doing.
Do you ever feel that you make some of your work to raise awareness about ignorance that we're experiencing?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, I don't want to preach. Yeah. Nobody's going to, I mean, you know, it's kind of a big club, the art club. You know, so actually one of the most exciting things that's happened to me is in a long time has been I did this piece called Perception of Risk. Well, there's a number of them. And they all have to do with, well, let me back up a little bit. I was listening to the radio about 3 or 4 years ago, and I heard somebody talking about the idea of plotting out how you perceive risk on a two-dimensional field, on an XY axis. And it stuck with me. It was like, wow, that's such a great idea. So I started making sketches of trying to plot out risk, either what I perceived as being dangerous to myself personally, and then mixed in with it is this sort of idea of what's a danger to people generally in the world. So, you know, for example, I might be terrified of falling. I'm going to, you know, fall down the stairs. But, you know, then there's this other sort of global catastrophic thing that might not affect me, but might, you know, wipe out 100,000 people in Indonesia or something. So there's this sort of dual thing going on. So I started making these charts on XY axis, and you'd have to look at them. There's a little diagram or kind of key that explains it at the bottom of each chart, and each one is graphed to the day that it's attached to what's going on in current events. So anyhow, this man, Baruch Fishcock, he's a professor at University of Pittsburgh, somehow heard about my work, or he's at Carnegie Mellon, and he does risk analysis. That's his field. And he somehow heard about my work. I don't know how. And he contacted me and asked me if I'd like to, if he could use my work on the front of one of his books. So I was delighted, of course, you know. So now I'm on this sort of like scholarly book cover about risk analysis and human behavior that Bishkov wrote. And then one of his circle of people found out about my work, and they've invited me to a conference in Santa Fe this January, all about risk. And it's people from the humanities, from the sciences, all these people in completely different fields. No artists. I'll be the only artist there. So to me, this is like really cool.
Yeah.
All my friends are artists. I love artists, but it's nice to get outside the club.
Mm-hmm.
So that should be really interesting.
That sounds totally fascinating.
Yeah.
Would you like to talk about some of the different series you've created throughout your career?
Well, I made a series of when we went into Iraq, and or after 9/11, the government was putting up all these, you know, all these sort of scare tactics to make us all feel very afraid. And so that's where a lot of this recent work has come from, kind of a reaction to that. One of the things they actually had on the government website was a 72-hour to-go pack. So it's this idea of, like, get everything together that you need to survive for 72 hours in case the unimaginable happens. And so I made various lists of the 72-hour to-go pack and changed them a little bit according to what I might take. But they're pretty straightforward, and then I just use the words. So I've done a number of projects that use the just lists of things, and assuming it can be shown on the
mm-hmm.
website. I'm working on a number of series I call After I'm Dead, that started with a little comment that my husband made to me when I was procrastinating about something. He was like, well, why don't you do that when you're dead? And it kind of spurred this whole series of lists that I make of things that I'll do when I'm dead. I'd rather procrastinate late. All these, it's sort of like a reverse bucket list. So I'm working with a lot of text, and I've done a number of series called A Perfect Description of the Celestial Orbs According to the Most Recent Doctrines of Intelligent Design, and those kind of refer to the fundamentalist religious and political attacks on rational thought. One of the things that I collect quotes and different, I have these big sketchbooks, and I'm always writing things down that stick with me. And one of my favorites is Mark Twain, who said that the trouble with the world is not that people know too little, but that they know so many things that just ain't so. So kind of human folly. I've also done a number of series that have to do with this area, with Buffalo, mapping the Niagara region, especially things like Love Canal. And I've been involved, outside of making art, I've been involved with the Clean Air Coalition of Western New York. I was one of the founding members, and we went out and did the first bucket brigades.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were doing that, it didn't feel like anything would ever happen or ever change. So that was pretty neat. To think that I had a hand in that.
And they're a very strong organization.
They are. They have a wonderful leader now, Erin Haney.
Yep.
Yeah, she's just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was a really valuable thing. And also working with people that weren't artists in the community. And a lot of people ask me, well, why don't you make art about that? But to me, it's like two separate things, and I want to keep them separate. I like keeping them separate. I think political art, most of it just falls flat on its face, unless you're doing something that's really radical, you know, like my colleague Steve Kurtz, which is a whole different ball game. And what he does, that can change things. But I don't feel like my work is that's not my focus.
Mm-hmm.
If my focus was to change things, I'd be more like a community organizer kind of activity. And I also like to do things like I'm involved with the Winnieback, with the Western New York Book Arts Collaborative, and I was there from the beginning, you know, demolishing and helping out here and there. So that's been a lot of fun too, just even it's that kind of, you know, team spirit, you know.
Yeah. It is interesting though, I mean, you talk about how you want to keep these spheres separate, and yet just in some of your works that I've seen, some
mm-hmm.
of your activism and perspectives mm-hmm. comes through.
Oh, of course.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe the distinction is I don't expect it to change the world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't, but yeah, it's all political.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about what's going on now and, you know, information overload. And I'm also very interested in design and communication. Like Edward Tufte is this fellow who's self-published a bunch of books about information design, and I've read them all like 3 times, and I just am fascinated by how to make something that is information readable visually without clutter, without too much information, making it comprehensible and yet dense. You know, like one of the things I did recently, don't ask me why, but I made a, it was inspired by Tufte, drawing of every single day of, over a period of 5 years of weather. So it included the amount of rain we had, the if it was cloudy, sunny, partly cloudy, if we had snow, sleet, what the temperature was, and I made it all on a drawing that's about four feet wide by about 2 feet high in a chart, in a graph. And I just went to the National Weather Service website and found what the particular conditions were each day, how much snow we got, how much rain we got, you know, if it was partly cloudy, sunny, whatever. And I made it all. So it's kind of an interesting thing because there are certain days when I was doing this chart that I was like, oh, I remember that summer. It was really hot and dry, and I had to water the garden every day, you know, so it was kind of...
It's kind of like a fine art infographic.
Mm-hmm. And I am also making a print out of it. You can... it'll be a letterpress print. So a lot of art practice for me is about kind of getting lost in the moment and trying to kind of... It's kind of like meditation. It's like you're paying attention to what you're doing, and it focuses everything. You can't slip. You know, a lot of people mistake it for tightness or for being rigid, but it's not. It's a choice to be precise.
As a printmaker, could you talk about some of the different printmaking techniques you've utilized throughout your career?
The first printmaking process I ever tried was lithography. You know, it's still used in commercial printing now. Probably not a whole lot longer when things go digital, but lithography was invented a little over 200 years ago, and it was originally done on rocks, marble, calcium carbonate, you know, stones from Bavaria. And basically what it is you draw with grease and pigment on this surface, the stone surface, and the greasy elements kind of sink into the surface and stay there. And then you... treat the remaining, the non-image areas, so that they'll retain water. So the way it's printed is that it's kept moist, the surface is kept moist, and the greasy marks attract the ink from the roller. So you ink it up with a hand roller and then print it with tremendous pressure on a press. And you can repeat that over and over again to obtain an addition. And if you want to use color, you have to have a different, each color requires a different matrix. So it's a very, in some ways, a very simple process, and in other ways, extremely complex. It's something that takes a lot of time and a lot of skill to master, and something that a lot of people don't know anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still teaching it at UB, and there's a lot of schools and a lot of artists around the country who are deeply wed to that process. It's a very sensual, the surface is, it's like it's drawing on this amazing surface. It's extremely responsive and receptive to every mark that you make. So there's nothing else like it. It's not like drawing on paper. It's different. You just have to kind of experience it. There's other printmaking processes that I use and teach, including intaglio, or etching, as it's also known, screen printing, or it's also known as letterpress, book arts, very time-consuming, very labor-intensive. Lots of times you can't do them without the help of other people, which is part of it.
Would you like to talk a little bit? You've really expressed your level of community involvement within the region, both connected and not connected with your art. But could you talk a little bit about Winnieback?
Sure. Winnieback is the Western New York Book Arts Collaborative. I think the word collaborative might be a little bit of a confusing at times. It'll probably become more known as the Book Arts Center. A little shorter title, maybe a little bit more precise. But it started out with Richard Kegler, who's an artist, amazing, talented guy, and his wife, Karima. They bought this building downtown. They really wanted to be downtown on the behalf of the Book Arts Collaborative, which was already in existence by then. And they gutted the building, renovated it. We're still have things to do. We need new windows and an elevator and a few things. But moved in a print collection, a bunch of printing presses, mainly Vandercook's, which are letterpress proof presses, along with movable type, both wood and lead, and all sorts of equipment that have to do with the book arts. So it was just, I think, 3 years ago that he bought this, or they bought this building, and in three short years, gone from nothing and this dungeon. It was just, when I went in there the first time, I thought Richard lost his mind. The amount of waste that was hauled out of there, I think, filled three dumpsters, big dumpsters. It was moldy in the basement. There was no heat or water in the basement. There still is, well, I think there is some water finally. And we did get some heat and ventilation eventually. But it was pretty tough going, and it's been a labor of love. He's had hundreds of volunteers, or they have had hundreds of volunteers. We now have a new executive director. I chaired the search for that. Forsberg, Jackson Forsberg, and he's wonderful. So I think that they're on a good footing now, and hopefully at a good time when Buffalo downtown seems to be coming back, and there's more and more people moving to the downtown area, and it's perfectly poised. Mm-hmm. And I think it'll be a not just a local but a international destination.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
And just the way they become such a strong, active part of the community with the Book Arts Fair every year. And what's coming up this weekend?
This weekend is a steamroller printing. Well, it's the Book Fest. I think it's the first time they've done this. And there's going to be all sorts of demonstrations and events going on. And one of the things, I made a woodcut. One of four artists who were invited to make woodcuts, 4 foot by 4 foot, that are going to be printed by hand, inked by hand, and printed with using a steamroller. That Anne Muchtas is heading up this project, and she's running the steamroller, and it was her idea, and we're going to do it. So it's going to be a lot of fun. And Barbara Rowe, Hei Young Shin, myself, and it's the woodblock is based on things to do after I'm dead.
That sounds incredible. I'll have such a good time with that this
weekend.
Yeah,
it'll be fun. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about your career as a fine artist? You've had numerous exhibitions. Can you talk a little bit about what you had to do to get to where you are in your career now as a professional artist?
As a professional artist, I don't really feel like I've made it. I feel like I'm in a very comfortable and privileged place, primarily because of teaching at the university, which I absolutely love. But, you know, I should say I was very lucky to be able to make a living teaching. And I worked very, very hard through coming up the ladder, you know, to get where I'm at. So it's not like it's been a cakewalk. I moved from Lincoln to Seattle to Arizona to New Mexico to Wisconsin, California, and finally to Buffalo. And when I got to Buffalo, I'm like, that's it. I'm done moving. I love this place. I want to stay here. It feels good. And that's when I was hired at UB. And I wasn't tenured. It took me, you know, the requisite 7 years to come up for tenure. And it was really hard. But I showed a lot. And I worked my ass off. and I got tenured, and then I became chair of the department, and I was chair of the department for 6 years, and that was hell. But I also got to meet a lot of really great people, and now I'm just teaching and enjoying it and trying to connect with my students. And so for me, exhibiting isn't a main focus. A main focus is making work. So I haven't really had any big one-person shows in a long time, and I'm invited to be in a lot of group shows. Mm-hmm. That's fine with me.
Mm-hmm. When you were a younger artist, maybe after Nebraska, maybe mm-hmm. after Arizona, when you would move to a new community, how would you get engaged with the art scene there? How would you get engaged with the gallery scene?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, I mean, that's a hard thing to do. You have to go to, you know, openings, meet people. It's really hard to break in. I really love Buffalo for that reason. I lived in Arizona in the Phoenix area for 5 years, and I had a big show there at the Scottsdale Center for the Arts, and I thought it was so exciting. You know, it's like this really premier, you know, place to have a show. And about 20 people showed up to the opening. And I was horrified.
Can I ask about what decade this was?
This was in the 85-ish or 84, somewhere around there. And then when I came to Buffalo, they had a little welcoming exhibit at Bethune Hall, which used to be part of the South Campus. And it was in the art department. And there were maybe 200 people at the opening. And I had only been in town for 2-3 months. So it was just like, it's night and day. You know, Buffalo has a really wonderful arts community. And it sounds like it's such a cliche. It's like what you tell anyone, but it's true. And people are very supportive here. And there's not much of a commercial scene, but there's a lot of community support.
And, you know, this is interesting because you've lived in so many different places. So it's not necessarily specific to Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
But can you talk about some of the support you got from the different communities or maybe needed and didn't get as you were a younger and more emerging artist?
Well, the problem with a lot of the places I lived is they were just so big and spread out. So it's not like you weren't getting support. There was support everywhere I lived, I think. You just had to find it. But it was more of just sort of the nature of the beast,
mm-hmm.
I think. Phoenix is just, it's just like L.A. It's just, there's artists everywhere, but there's no, like, central focus of activity.
So having a more centralized arts community here made a big difference?
Yeah, and also just, you know, having a job where you meet a lot of different people in the arts helps. And also getting older, it's really important to meet people. Like, if you have a show in Philadelphia, you got to go to the opening, even if it's a group show, and, you know, meet people. I go to a lot of conferences. I know a lot of artists from all around the country, mainly printmakers, because I go to these printmaking conferences, and there's usually 1,000, 1,500 people at these things, and they're ever-changing. Young students, you know, young people coming up who are doing amazing work. It's always very humbling to go to these things. And you see some of the amazing work that's going on out there. I wish I could spread printmaking fever everywhere.
Can I ask a little bit about when did you decide you wanted to become a professor? And when you kind of started to figure that out, what did you have to do to find teaching positions?
Okay. Well, I never thought I'd get a job, but I thought I had to try. So, you know, what do you do when you go to art school? You know, you teach. I mean, that was the sort of idea back then, even though everybody knew it wasn't necessarily going to be like that. So I had a professor in Arizona State who actually designed a course to help students there learn how to apply for a job and how to create a resume and how to go through an interview and what question, how to prepare yourself and what questions to ask. And his name was Leonard Lair, and he's still alive. Him and practically all the grads I went to school with who were in this class all got teaching jobs. And at the time, there were more jobs, but it wasn't like they were, you know, plentiful. It was still very competitive. When I applied here for a part-time position at UB, there were over 100 applications. And that was, you know, in 85 or 86. But anyways, I just applied to part-time sabbatical replacement positions when I started out, and I got one job, and then that went fine, and then I kept applying, and I got another job. They were all like, you know, one semester, two semester, and then that just kept happening until I had enough experience under my belt that I could actually qualify for a good job, which my priority was to be at a university, not a private college, and to be somewhere where there was a graduate program was really important to me. I lucked out. Well, actually, when I came here, it was just a part-time position, and Harvey Breverman, who hired me, was thinking that, you know, it might turn into full-time, because I replaced a full-time person. So actually, I was doing full-time work, but I was paid part-time. But you have to do that, you know. You just have to. It's not easy. After grad school, I drove taxi. I delivered pizza. I was a waitress. I was an artist assistant. What else did I do? I don't remember. There were so many little things. But, you know, it takes a long time. And it doesn't make any sense. I mean, some people I thought would get hired, you know, get a job, haven't. And other people, I hear, who got a job? You know, it's like, it just doesn't make any sense. Some people interview well, other people don't.
So here's a question for you. During your time as the director of the graduate program, was that your proper title?
Mm-hmm.
Did you create any sort of course like Leonard Lair did about, like, how to get a job for artists?
Yeah, I did. And it's been sort of incorporated into the program now, so it's not so much a course with us, you know, like we meet here and here, but we try to incorporate portions of it, like, for example, bringing people from outside in to talk, and Sean Donaher is someone who comes frequently, and he talks to them about, like, how to get his attention as a curator, or how to introduce yourself, and strategies for getting known in a community.
That's great.
Yeah, practical things like that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So my last and final question is, what advice do you have for emerging artists who are starting to build their career?
You have to get out. You have to meet people. You can't just be alone in your studio. Say yes to everything. You never know where something's going to lead. It could just be a minor thing, but you might meet someone that down the road will, you know, connect you to someone else. And it's not about brown nosing, but you have to put a face to it, and you can't look down on it like you're above it, you know. And you just never know who people are and what, you know, who might be interested in your work. There's a market for everybody's work. I don't care if you draw bunnies and lollipops, you know. I mean, you have to find, there is a market out there. And I don't mean so much in a way of, like, selling yourself out, but just stay, you know, no one's going to care if you don't care. So you have to care about your work. You have to do what comes from you and be yourself and not try to please anyone. And then you'll find a place for it. You'll find people who appreciate it.
Adele, thank you so much for coming in today and participating in the Living Legacy Project at the Birchfield Penny Arts Center.